Please listen carefully.
You are listening to the Ardent Development Podcast. I'm Ron Smith.
And I'm Derek Hatchard. Whatever your role in the software development industry, join us in our search for inspiration and insights for builders and leaders.
Go to ardentdev.com to find more interviews and subscribe by email. Follow us on Twitter at ardentdev. We are joined today with Mike Herchuk, who has been trapped in the world of quality since he first did his user acceptance testing 19 years ago. He has survived all the different levels and a wide spectrum of technologies and environments to become the quality dynamo that he is today. Mike believes in creating a culture of quality through software production and tries hard to create teams that hold this ideal and advocate it to the rest of their workmates. Mike's currently the director of quality for PQA testing, but has previously worked in social media management, parking, manufacturing, web photo retail, music delivery kiosks, and railroad. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you, Mike.
Glad to have you. Now, you just finished up at a conference. We thought we'd have you on to talk a little bit about your first talk that you gave there, Augmenting the Agile Team, a Testing Success Story.
Well, sure, for sure. So Agile for me is a bit of a passion, I think. I really believe in the power of Agile. But one of the things that I've learned in working with people who do Agile is that when people self-teach or when they have bad coaches, people seem to believe that there's a right way to do Agile, that there's one way to do Agile. And they go out and they find a how-to guide for how to do Agile, and it teaches you how to implement it. But the problem with that is that every situation is incredibly different, and that Agile isn't really set up to be a how-to guide. It has a manifesto, it's a set of concepts, and it's something that everyone who adopts it has to figure out how to do it right. And so I had a project that we did with one of our clients. So we're a testing as a service company, and we got involved with one of our clients where we did an assessment and helped them figure out what they needed to be successful in some of the work they were doing. And one of the things that we were looking at with them was, is what they're doing Agile wrong? Is it doing it right? And I have this personal mission to make sure that no one believes that you're doing Agile wrong is a term that you can hear. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the concept, but when I hear that, it just makes me angry, because Agile is an iterative approach to everything, and it's the way that there's no way that it needs to be done. You're doing it right if it's working for you. And so this talk that I put together is sort of a case study from a project where we did take and went way off the standard realm of Agile and did it our own way. And I talk about how we did it, what the problems were, and what the success was, to help people see that doing Agile your own way is probably the best path to success.
It's an interesting topic. Oh, absolutely. It's an interesting topic, because it's, as you go from company to company and do different assignments there, you see Agile implemented in different ways. And I think if you talk to the folks that are involved in projects, they would actually give you a slightly different slant, which I think, you know, exasperates this topic of, you know, are we doing it right? Because IT is often, you know, years ago, there's a right and a wrong way, if you will, right? There, it seems. But this is, yeah, this seems, sure, so much more fluid. I think people are having a hard time knowing, you know, are we doing this well? Are we doing it right?
Well, and for someone who grew up in waterfall, who spent years having lists of things that you need to do things properly, Agile is so different from that. And I think that's one of the reasons that some people, and I hesitate to call people old timers, but if that's your mindset, maybe that's the right way to say it. You get stuck in that mindset, and Agile has too much change. It's just too fluid, and it's difficult for you to go into that new world where you might have to be able to shift every 2 weeks. You might have to be able to shift the way you're doing things, because you're supposed to be iterating to make things better. So the client, I won't name names, but the client is a Canadian client that produces a retail management solution, or an RMS, for mobile phone kiosks. So when you go into a mobile phone place in a mall or wherever you go and you buy a phone, and probably not the ones that are actually branded Fido or Bell or whatever, probably one of the other ones, although they sell to carriers as well. But when you go into one of those and you buy a phone, one of the things that they need to do is they not only have to track the purchase of the phone, they also have to set up provisioning for the phone. So that when you walk out of that kiosk, that you have a phone that is connected to the carrier and that does what it needs to do. So they produce software that takes care of that, takes care of the selling and takes care of that. And they've also extended it and tried to make it an option that will sell and take care of all of the needs of that client. So it also takes care of employment stuff. It takes care of inventory. It takes care of reporting and tries to take care of all the things. And really what ends up being is it ends up being a very, very complex system. So anyone who's worked in an ERP knows that it's like an octopus, only not eight arms, like a million arms that thread in through all different things. And so there's a lot of integration points for that. And then, so they were having some problems with one of their end clients, which is what I term one of our clients who is working with someone else down the line. We call that the end client, sort of like end user. And when they work with that end client was a name of one of the major carriers in the US, and they did 40% of the business for my client. So what they did is they had a lot of clout in conversations about features and things. And that end client had 15 other vendors delivering solutions that all built together into their integrated system that made them successful.
So it's an octopus of octopuses.
Yeah, every octopus arm had other octopuses living off them that's kind of mutated. What that meant, though, was that the sit testing, the integrated testing environment, system integration environment, was very necessary and complex because you couldn't test on your own box. You can't test for what's going to happen when you have 15 other vendors delivering pieces of not code necessarily, but messaging and communication and interfaces and all of that into one integrated system that's going to work. So we had this healthy integration system. And then to make it even more complicated, the RMS system that the client was producing, they had 13 different feature teams feeding features to this. And they had one consolidated product that went out to all customers. But the Zen client that owned 40% of the business, they were also responsible for getting specific features that worked not necessarily just for that end client, but there were things that only that end client wanted and they had enough sway to get them for them. So there were in one solid rollout that went everywhere, there were feature flags for some things that only worked for that end client. And then there were features that went both ways, features that other feature groups were delivering that the end client had to use and things that the end client was asking for that would also go to work for all the other clients. So if I haven't illustrated something that's really complex to you yet, maybe I can add more.
Oh, there's more?
Well, other things that complicated it for us was they had the environments were very, let's call it rich to be polite. There were 32 different environments between dev, staging, and test, and more could be done at a whim if necessary. So their monthly release cadence, the end client took their versions 1 month after everyone else. So everyone else would get the release, say in January, and then it would have a month to solidify and make sure it was okay, and then the end client would get their stuff a month forward. So now we're talking version control problems, where which version are we fixing in this? Which pieces that we fix here have to go there? And the code that's specific for the end carrier, does it have to go into the version that's going to production? Maybe that's enough complexity.
That is very complex, especially when you look at the additional teams behind the end client. But today, we're seeing this so much with these environments that an octopus is a good way to describe it, but it doesn't even do it justice because of how, when you're multiplying that against the different environments and then managing what piece of code is in what environment versus a database version versus the data that's in it, and timing all of that, that in itself is complicated, let alone what you're building for the software.
Yeah, it was pretty positive on the part of our client that they had enough gumption to make statements like, no, when we write features, everyone gets the features. They had to compromise a little and say to this person who produced 40% of their business and said, okay, so you need something special, we'll add that on. But that's an additional feature. Any feature that went to everyone went to them as well. So, I mean, that was pretty positive. I've seen where that's not been the case in the past, and that makes it horrific.
That makes for disaster down the road.
Yeah.
When everybody gets customized versions of the software.
And so when you take all of that complexity that I just talked about, and then you say, hey, so how well did sprints and agile work? That's where we start running into the problem. So, I mean, my focus is always on, hey, how does testing work? Does it work okay? And the big problem that they rolled into, that the amount of complexity that we're talking about, both within the product itself and then the different integration touch points, meant that there was a pretty big regression suite that needed to be gone through. And there was automation, and automation could do so much, but there was troublesome with the end client piece, just in terms of time, and I'll get to that in a second. So what would happen is the feature team, there was one feature team that was dedicated to the end client, making sure they had the features that they needed and they integrated properly with everything else. And they would go through their sprints, and they had two QA in their team, and it was a pretty standard agile team, you know, 5 or 6 devs and a product owner and a couple of QA. And things worked pretty well. And, you know, they produced a feature and the QA tested the feature and made sure it was okay, until you got to the point of saying, hey, let's release. Now, remember, they're releasing once a month. And when they get to that point, they say, okay, so now we have to run the regression suite. And we also have these deadlines because we actually have a target date for each of these releases. And what they would get is, I don't know, there's 700 or 800 test cases in the regression suite. And you have two guys who are set up to do that. And of course, they have to break sprint with the feature sprint in order to do this, because they have to dedicate wholly to that. And indeed, there's not enough man hours and two people to make that happen either, and not and meet dates. So what they would do is they'd go to the other 12 feature teams and they'd say, we're going to die and this is an important client. I need help. And so they would get QAs from other teams to help them. So they would then break their sprints. So we're breaking sprints all over the place. You're not getting a continuity of knowledge, because you aren't going to be able to go to the same agile team every time and say, I need your QA. You're going to get the one that where they're in a place where maybe they can spare someone and not cause disaster. So you're not even getting continuity of knowledge in the way that the end client specific stuff works. So when they came to us and talked to us, we were in the situation where sprints were being broken all over the place. And the end result of that was that, so they were still shipping, but they were getting more bugs into SIT than anyone was happy with, more bugs out of SIT and into production than anyone was happy with. And because of the complexity of all the things we're talking about, when they found issues, finding the right person to work on these issues and finding communication about how they'll be worked on and when they'll be delivered was very slapshod. And it was making the end client quite grumpy. And you never want the client that's producing 40% of your revenue being very grumpy.
Indeed.
So that's where we came in, right? So they just knew that something about quality was broken, and they pulled us in and said, hey, can you do an assessment? So we did an assessment and made a bunch of different suggestions, recommendations that they could do things better. And the big one that they jumped on and that we figured out was, let's talk about this augmenting testing team idea that you have. And so that's where we looked at the problem and we looked at the idea and we said, well, really the problem here is that you don't have enough people doing testing. So we could just give you 4 or 5 or 6 testers. And what would you do with them? And we said, well, if we inject 6 testers into your agile team, that's going to break things in a different way. It's not going to work. So should we spin up another agile team, which is, you know, I mean, the next step that you get to. And like, yeah, but what are we going to do with the normal ratio of having a bunch of devs and a product owner on a team? What will they do all the time? And we said, do we really need them? Do we really have to be tied to this concept that the team needs to have devs on it? And we said, nope, which is easy for testers to say. Maybe not so easy for you guys to agree to, but it was easy for us testers to say. And so we spun up a parallel team. So that's why we call it an augmenting team. And that team was responsible for regression testing and integration testing for code that was going to go to the end carrier. And we had a mixed team. So there was a team lead and a team lead for communication and a senior. And that senior became an expert in all of the complex systems. Then we added some juniors so that they could take care of the big giant set of regression tests. And we also added an automator so that we could start claiming back some of the time that was being lost. The company, the client, has a good, solid automation practice. What they didn't have with how often they were breaking sprint for this end client, there was just no time to ever get automation done.
So basically, you took that agile team that was in place the first time, and those testers that were coming, they were breaking off the sprint because they were getting overloaded when it came to releases. and you said to those first testers, stay with the sprint team, and we're going to form this other team kind of trailing in order to do the testing for the releases and the integrations. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we had full-time work because it was a monthly cadence. So we worked in parallel. So we were taking care of regression. Then we were taking care of sit. At the same time, in parallel to that, the feature team was working on the features for the next release. And so that feature team and the QA on that feature team, they owned those features and they would functional test those features and make sure that they were okay. And when they were ready to come out into staging, they would hand it all over to us and demo the features. And we would take over responsibility for regression testing, those features as well as the regular regression testing suite, and move it into sit and then take care of the integration testing. And so we took a lot of that load off of everyone. And we also took over the entire communication suite. So one of the other challenges that the client had was, if you get an issue, you find an issue in sit, that issue could have originated with that one feature team or any one of the other 12 feature teams. Coordinating, doing triage on that, getting someone to go in and debug it and fix it and find a solution and deliver a solution, and couple all of that with a communication and delivery SLA that you have with your end client, and things were getting lost and misplaced, and you just never knew the status of things. And so we dedicated one person on our team who took ownership of communication and tracking all of those things, and It made the end client very happy.
So did your approach deal with any changes of the environment setup as well, or the number of environments? Because that sounds like a heavy load, just the number of environments you described coming in.
So they hadn't really done anything to fix anything in that area prior to our coming. What we took on was some environment coordination tasks. So we knew which things had to be in which environments for us. There were other environments that we just said, we don't care about those. If you need those for whatever reason, so payments might need their own environment to do some investigation into issues or whatever, and they could just own that. And we took on responsibility of making sure that our needs were met with the different versions that we were working on. Because, of course, there were also hot fixes that would move to these environments and et cetera. So we just took on ownership of knowing where everything needed to be to make sure that the stuff that the end client's expectations were met, that they were going to get a version that they could work with when they needed to work with. And that was so positive, just our taking ownership of that. And they saw the benefits of that, that they went out and hired a full-time, I think they called the title QA coordinator, but really their job was to coordinate to make sure that the right things were in the right places and we understood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's something that you see when you work in a small environment. If you have one agile team, regardless of the flavor of agile, we have this, there's definitely this prevailing notion that, well, hey, they can just take care of everything. But as the number of teams grow, there is coordination, connective tissue, things like you mentioned, Mike, the handoff from this team during regression found an issue, but really the issue belongs to the other team. There's so much that has to get taken care of in order for the organization to be efficient. I'm super fascinated by this approach. One of the things that and I don't think Ron's ever heard me say this, but one of the things that I've said to other people in the past is that as you build features, you are accumulating effectively extra work for yourself in the future. So you build a feature and you test it now, but you want to always make sure that feature is working, especially as you glue new things onto your system. Eventually, you will get to the point, if you keep building features, where it takes you longer to regression test than you actually have time in your release cycle. And so you could get to this point where all you ever do is regression testing, and you really have to do one of two things. You have to augment your regression in some way, which is what you're talking about, or you have to be able to automate it, which is basically another form of augmenting your team. Otherwise, you just eventually have to stop regression testing things.
I think when you start talking about those kind of problems, that you need to implement an integrated automation strategy, which includes as full a coverage of unit testing as you can, and understanding that coming out of each sprint, that you've automated what you need to automate so that you don't have to do these complicated regression passes. I don't think that's the full solution for the case study I'm talking about, because you're always going to have to do the sit testing because of the 15 other vendors. So I think that the solution that we had, like maybe we could have invested a whole bunch of money and done a whole bunch of automation and then said, okay, now we just have to maintain it. But that wouldn't have been enough, because there's still that integration testing, the having the other people involved at that point. I mean, you can't mock them all out and expect that you're going to get the right results in the end, because they're not as clean as a mock is, right? So in this situation, they're always going to do some level of sit testing, but there are other situations without the 15 other vendors that if you have a good solid automation strategy where you're thinking about what you need to automate at the same time as you're thinking about what you have to code, then I think you can go a long way towards saving yourself having to have a parallel augmentation team.
There's no question that that's testing in the presence of integrations to third-party systems that are out of your control is just so, it makes it so much more complicated. It's so true. You can build really interesting software that way, but man, it is hard. Yeah, you make a really good point there.
It's really tricky too when you look at the spectrum of maturity of the different vendors, because often you go with a vendor that has the right type of functionality base that you want as part of your solution, and then you have to dig to find out, well, where are they on the spectrum, and how do I manage that differently? Because there's a very mature method with the vendor one, and there's a very immature method with vendor two.
Yeah, no, that's true. And sometimes you just have to take it on faith. Faith that end vendor is going to be as hard-assed with everyone else as they are with you, making sure that you're delivering quality. So as long as you trust them to deliver interfaces that match the specs, then you code to that. And then because I'm a tester, you say, well, then you test for that. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, things should work out okay. And then you also have some bugs. And so you have to build in the buffer to test for it and make sure that you keep it fixed. But yeah, at no point do I ever think that you can just say, hey, we'll trust everyone and everything will work, because just miscommunication can make that not true.
Speaking of miscommunication, I know that I was looking through your blog that you have, and I know you do a little bit of writing about behavior-driven development. And yep. I wondered if you would touch on that for a minute.
For sure. So one of the things that we've done here at PQA is so we have one guy we hired in, and he'd done a bunch of BDD, so that's behavior-driven development. And so he said, this should be something that we advocate for our customers where it's right. And we said, okay, teach us. So he taught us about it. And we've done it. We've implemented it with a few of our customers where there was a need. So the big thing, so BDD is an offshoot of TDD, test-driven development. And the way it changes, the focus of behavior-driven development is the concept that a lot of the issues that you get post-development when you've delivered the product is you're delivering a product that the client never actually asked for. So that somewhere between the client saying, I want a feature that does A, B, and C, someone interpreted it, because we're humans and every single thing we say has room for miscommunication and interpretation. So it goes through a product manager, a BA, and a dev, and all of us have different brains, and our brains work in different ways, and we have different kinds of focuses, and it's totally understandable that all of that happens, and you end up with a tester, and the tester says, I don't think this is what they asked for. And I mean, that's one of the specialties of the tester mindset, and one of the reasons that we exist, is that we specialize in going back and trying to reinterpret what was originally said to make sure that what was built really is that. And I don't think any blamer, I think only moderate blame here goes back to the developers, because it's human nature to have these interpretations. It's human nature to write one thing that can be read in 3 different ways, right? And it's a pretty specific skill set to write things that are useful in that way. And maybe back in waterfall days where we had specs that were thousands of pages long, we feel that we got those requirements down to a level where no mistakes can be made, but we know that's not true either. But when you move into Agile, which is supposed to be documentation light, and you're writing things in plain English, it raises the problem up even further. So I forget the guy's name, but this guy came up with the idea, well, what if we shift all this stuff to the left, and we come up with this idea of having discussions about what we're going to build before we build it, so we all get on the same page. And so BDD comes with this concept of the Three Amigos meeting. And the Three Amigos meeting happens right after you start the sprint and you're going to work on feature X. So you take that feature tag or the work item, and you say, okay, let's have the Three Amigos meeting. And so the product owner, so someone who is advocating for the client and most likely to be able to parrot what the client says, and in some cases you can actually have the client present for that, and the developer and the tester, they sit down and they have a meeting to discuss the feature. And the meeting can be 15 minutes long, it can be an hour and a half long, it really depends on how complex what it is that you're working on. And you talk about the solution. You talk about what it is the developer is actually going to do because it's actually what they want. And you walk out of that meeting with all three people on the same page. And this saves time in test because the tester, when they get it, they really understand what the acceptance criteria are. And the developer has the same understanding. So theoretically, they're going to produce the same product that is being expected. And it really saves on having produced the wrong thing.
You spend time translating in the beginning so that it's not an oops at the end.
Yeah, you spend time in that conversation. So it's a pot of translation. You're all there hashing it out. So in the end, you don't have to do any translation yourself because you're all speaking the same language.
Oh, go ahead, Derek.
This is an audio podcast, so you can't see me nodding my head, but it's so true. The three amigos rule, or the rule of three, it makes such a huge difference.
Yeah, and it's not right for every client, but we've created this thing that we call testing focused BDD, and it's just a little framework that we have that helps our people who are going in and talking to a client and looking at the problems that they're having and saying, you know what, we think BDD is right for you. And it's not right for every client, but as soon as you have a client who says, yeah, our biggest problem is we develop and we produce really good things, and then we have to send them back for rework. And that's ting, that's a flag where we say, oh, is this right for BDD? Let's see if it's something that they could do and be useful with.
Is that testing-focused BDD framework something that you share externally, or is it something that is proprietary within your company?
It is something that we are thinking about taking to conferences this coming year. So it's not something that we've written externally yet, but it's something that we're going to start doing.
Okay, awesome. Well, we'll keep our eyes out for that then.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting, Mike. I think we could hang out all afternoon and chat. If
probably
other
could.
People wanted to, get in touch with you, where are you on the web, and what's the contact information where they could find you?
It's Mike Hrcyk, and I'm going to spell the name for you because Hrcyk.
Just like it's pronounced.
Yeah, just like it's pronounced. Absolutely. No vowels. So I blog rather intermittently at www.qaisdoes, that's qaisdoes.com. That came out of my brain at one point. I said QA is as QA does, and then I went out and found a URL that matched for me. I Twitter at qaisdoes. My professional career is at PQA Testing. So as I said, we're a testing as a service company, and we consider ourselves testing experts, and we'll help any company that has testing needs to figure out how to solve their problem. You can go to pqatesting.com for that. If you're all friends of Ron and Derek and therefore local to Fredericton, that's where our home office is, but we have 6 offices across Canada, and I'm in our Vancouver office.
Well, that's great, Mike. I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon with us. It's a really interesting topic, so thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. I had a good time. You're welcome to invite me back someday.
You've been listening to the Ardent Development Podcast. Be sure to visit us at ardentdev.com for the show notes, including links to the books and resources mentioned. And don't forget to sign up for email notifications so that you're the first to know about new episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at ardentdev. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review on iTunes, as it helps other people discover the podcast. Thanks for listening.